is the news.
Russian President Vladimir Putin makes a surprise visit to Mariupol, his first trip to the Ukrainian city since it was captured by Russia. French police clash with protesters in Paris and Nantes amid anger over the government's decision to push through its pension reform bill. And more than a dozen people are killed and many buildings are destroyed following a powerful earthquake that hit parts of Ecuador and Peru. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, the Russian president has made a surprise visit to Mariupol, his first trip to the Ukrainian city since it was captured after a lengthy siege at the start of the Russia-Ukraine war. Vladimir Putin flew to Mariupol by helicopter and took a tour of the city. He visited several sites and spoke with residents. Putin's stop in Mariupol comes after a surprise visit to Crimea to mark the 9th anniversary of the peninsula's annexation. The trips came after an arrest warrant was issued for Putin by the International Criminal Court over Russia's alleged deportation of thousands of Ukrainian children. The Kremlin has dismissed as void the validity of the warrant. Kosovo blames Serbia for the failure to sign a landmark EU brokered deal to normalize relations.
The other side, just as in the last meeting in Brussels on 27th of February, is avoiding signing the agreement, now also with the annex. It is now up to the European Union to find the mechanism to make the status of this agreement legally and internationally binding.
Albin Kurti made the remarks after a trilateral meeting with his Serbian counterpart and the EU foreign policy chief in North Macedonia. Separately, Serbian president said both sides have reached some sort of agreement, but the implementation plan will definitely have to be upgraded. The EU has described the negotiations as difficult. Last month, Kosovo and Serbia agreed to a deal to normalize relations following nearly 10 years of EU-mediated talks. French police have clashed with protesters for the third straight day as anger mounts over President Emmanuel Macron's pension reforms. Rallies were held in several cities across the country. In the capital, Paris, police banned protests outside the parliament after gatherings there the two previous nights led to clashes between demonstrators and security forces. On Thursday, Macron invoked a controversial executive power to force through a bill on the state pension age without a parliamentary vote. The move has also angered the political class, presenting the 45-year-old leader with one of his biggest challenges less than a year into his second and final mandate. Opposition lawmakers have filed two motions of no confidence in the government, which are to be debated in Parliament on Monday. Kazakhstan is holding snap parliamentary elections. 12 million people are eligible to vote. Seven political parties are participating in the vote. Independent candidates are allowed to run for the first time in nearly two decades. A 30% quota has been introduced for women, young people, and people with disabilities. President Kasym Jomart Tokayev dissolved parliament in January and announced the early vote as part of what has been called a modernization drive. The decision was made following last year's deadly protests against fuel prices. However, critics accused the Central Asian country's president of trying to consolidate power by such reforms. Elsewhere, at least 13 people are killed in a strong earthquake that jolted a coastal region in southern Ecuador. The government said the 6.8 magnitude earthquake left 11 people dead in the province of El Oro and two fatalities in Azuay province. It added that multiple homes, educational buildings, and health centers were also damaged. The earthquake also shook Peru. Peruvian authorities said that the quake was felt in the country's northern region, claiming the life of a four-year-old girl. Tens of thousands of people hit the streets of Tel Aviv for the 11th consecutive week against the policies of the new Israeli far-right cabinet. Similar protests also took place in the settlements of Haifa, occupied Al-Quds, the settlement of Beersheba, and hundreds of other towns and cities across the occupied Palestinian territories. The protesters are angry at Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's proposed judicial reforms. If approved, the legislation would increase the cabinet's influence in choosing judges and limit the powers of the Supreme Court to overturn the cabinet's decisions. Critics argue that the legal changes will foster corruption and bring diplomatic isolation. The reforms are the cornerstone of Netanyahu's cabinet, an alliance of ultra-Orthodox and extreme right parties, which took office late December. Meanwhile, Hamas's deputy chief says the Palestinian resistance movement will file a lawsuit against Israel in the International Criminal Court. Musa Abu Marzouk says the regime must be held to account for its war crimes against Palestinians. Abu Marzouk pointed to the four Israeli wars on the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as the desecrations of Palestinian holy sites, demolition of their homes, and confiscation of their lands. These, he said, constitute war crimes that should be prosecuted. Marzouk was addressing a conference against occupation. The regime has recently intensified its crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. The violence has left 89 Palestinians dead so far this year. Saudi Arabia conducts new attacks on Yemen, leaving three more civilians dead and several others injured in the northwestern province of Sa'dah. Two of the victims lost their lives in an artillery attack on the border district of Sha'dah. Six other people were also wounded in gunfire and shellings in the same district. In a separate attack, the Saudi-led forces also killed a man in the district of Munaba. Riyadh, along with some regional allies and backed by the United States, launched a war in Yemen back in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Years of aerial strikes and shelling, as well as a blockade by the Saudi-led coalition, have devastated the country and left hundreds of thousands of civilians dead. Representatives of Arab parties from various countries have arrived in the Syrian capital, Damascus. They met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and held an emergency meeting of the General Conference of Arab Parties. Our correspondent in Damascus, Muhammad Ali, has the details in this report.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad received heads of Arab political parties who arrived in Damascus to hold an emergency meeting of the General Conference of Arab Parties. Assad said there is currently an opportunity for political parties to take action in resisting the siege imposed on the countries they represent, underlining the importance of dialogue in expanding the conference to include various political movements and forces. Head of the conference, Qasem Saleh, expressed solidarity with Syrians affected by the earthquakes. Members of the delegation called for ending the occupation of Syrian lands, lifting the U.S. economic siege, and activating joint Arab action.
We can convey to President Assad our stances and listen to his advices for activating joint Arab action and the role of youth. We are betting on the youth at this stage for finding creative solutions for political, economic, and social challenges.
Representatives of parties then held the 63rd emergency meeting of the General Conference of Arab Parties. They underlined the importance of respecting Syria's sovereignty and unity and rejected unilateral economic sanctions on Syria. They asserted that resistance blocked the implementation of a colonialist plot in the region that aimed at eliminating the Palestinian cause and defeating Syria.
We unconditionally stand with Syrian people, army, and leadership, which paid a heavy price to defend just Arab causes. Syria is the source of our history and civilizations. Arab states should return to Syria.
What happens in Syria affects Lebanon and vice versa. We entered into Syria at a particular time in support of its leadership, army, and people. We came to Syria to defend Lebanon. If Syria had collapsed, the whole region would have collapsed. Even Iran's support to Syria was aimed at defending Iran because Syria was the first defense line of all resistance forces in the region.
Participants rejected all forms of normalization with Israel. They welcomed the restoration of diplomatic relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, underlining it would greatly contribute to solving regional problems. The conference is being held at a time Syrians are extremely suffering from the repercussions of a foreign-backed conflict, unilateral sanctions, and most recently, the devastating earthquake. It's a wake-up call to the international community to take urgent actions and help resolve Syria's dilemmas. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Meanwhile, a pro-Syria sit-in has been held in Rome and in a number of capitals across the world as part of a campaign called End the Siege. The initiative was in solidarity with the Syrian people who are suffering from the sanctions imposed on their country by the West.
On Saturday, sit-ins were held in several countries across the world as part of a campaign aimed at denouncing the devastating effects of the sanctions imposed by the US and the European Union on Syria. The initiative, named End the Siege, has been joined by organizations based in a dozen countries, including Jordan, Palestine, Lebanon, the UK, Germany and Canada. Italy's sit-in was held in Rome in front of the Colosseum, where members of the No War Network and the U.S. Citizens for Peace and Justice denounced how U.S. and EU sanctions have devastated Syria's economy and led to immense human suffering.
Syria is greatly suffering the consequences of the criminal sanctions imposed by our governments, particularly after the earthquake that hit that country over a month ago. Frustration about being excluded from assistance is growing, and I believe it is a scandal that the EU can't act independently, but it has to always submit to the US diktat.
Demonstrators at the sit-in said that the US must leave Syria and stop profiting from Syrian oil and wheat that has exacerbated the poverty in the country. Italy and Syria once maintained a robust relationship, but in 2012, 1 year after the Syrian conflict, Rome joined its Western allies in closing its embassy in Damascus. 7 years later, in 2019, when Italy had an anti-establishment government under the leadership of the Five Star Movement and the Northern League, it appeared that Rome was mulling over normalizing relations with Damascus and reopening its embassy there. However, something went wrong.
It happened that the then government was under enormous pressure, particularly by the United States. Everybody knows that Italy is a country with limited sovereignty. Washington demanded Rome to stop liaising with Damascus the same way it has forced Italy to join the war in Ukraine. One third of Syria is today occupied by American soldiers, and the U.S.'s thefts of Syrian oil, natural gas, and other mineral resources have led to energy shortages.
We're here today to do, because this is the 20th anniversary of the invasion and occupation of Iraq by United States troops. They still have a NATO contingent. 1,000 Italian troops are leading the contingent to rob the oil from northeast Iraq, impoverish the Iraqis, and send the oil to Turkey, Israel, and clients of the United States.
The February 6th earthquake has further worsened the already deteriorating economy and humanitarian situation in Syria. According to UN sources, even before the earthquake tragedy, 70% of the population needed humanitarian assistance due to the war in the country and the US-EU sanctions. Max Civili, Rome.
The Iran-Russia-China joint maritime exercises, dubbed Combined Maritime Security Belt Exercise 2023, have come to an end. The trilateral drill was wrapped up after the naval forces of the participating countries conducted anti-piracy exercises and marine firefighting operations in the northern part of the Sea of Oman. Our correspondent Mehdi Abbasian has a report.
The combined joint drill of Iran, China, and Russia in the north of Oman Sea has ended with a parade of participating vessels in front of the Iranian Jamaran destroyer.
We have successfully wrapped up the final day of the joint exercise. On the last day, we practiced rescuing a ship hijacked by pirates and extinguished the fire of a damaged ship. These important exercises were aimed at improving security in the northern part of the Indian Ocean, as well as countering maritime piracy and terrorism. We have managed to achieve all predetermined goals of the drill. Our main goal is to attract the collective participation of friendly and aligned countries in this region.
On the final day of the 2023 Maritime Security Belt exercise, with the presence of the naval forces of Iran, China, and Russia, the maritime and aerial units of the three countries carried out fire extinguishing operations. They also conducted rescue and relief operations of the injured, as well as towing a damaged ship to a port. In another exercise, special operations teams of Iran, China, and Russia practiced freeing a trade vessel that had been hypothetically hijacked by pirates in international waters. In this part of the exercise, arresting the pirates, countering the acts of sabotage by pirates to delay rescue operation, and also treating the injured were successfully conducted.
Our goal from conducting this exercise was cooperation based on mutual respect. We believe powerful countries like Iran, China, and Russia can play an important role in helping the global economy and security.
The 2023 Maritime Security Belt Joint Exercise is the fourth joint naval exercise of Iran, Russia, and China in recent years. Kazakhstan and Pakistan were also present as observers in this year's exercise. Admiral Irani said the naval units of these countries will participate in 2024 joint exercise.
The exercises are the latest in the joint drills by Iran, China, and Russia. Iran says all regional countries are most welcome to take part in the next year drills because they are the ones that are truly in charge of establishing security in the region. Mahdi Abbasian, Konarak.
That brings an end to World News for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Congratulations to everyone at the start of spring and revival of nature. departure.
Welcome back to Aperture. The illegal recycling of electronics is a toxic business on a global scale. Every year, three-quarters of electronic waste from Europe and the U.S. disappears from official recycling system and is shipped illegally to India, China, or Africa. In the first part of the documentary, we took you on an investigative journey through Africa, China, Europe, and the U.S. in an effort to unravel the out-of-control corrupt systems enabling illegal e-waste recycling. Stay with us as we further investigate to reveal the apparatus of large-scale trafficking, as well as a complex chain of responsibility and collusion in the next part of the program.
The U.S. is the only country in the world, apart from Haiti, that has not ratified the Basel Convention, the international agreement banning the export of toxic waste. To make matters worse, the U.S. government itself is as bad as anyone else when it comes to recycling its own discarded equipment.
The U.S. government is the single biggest producer of electronic waste on the planet.
Discarded electronics of whole departments are routinely put out to public auction instead of being sent to trustworthy recyclers.
Whoever gives the government the best rate, in other words, they can take it for free or almost for free, the government is kind of obliged to do that because in our laws you're supposed to go the cheapest way to save the taxpayer money. But the cheapest way is the dirtiest way.
Recyclers who do actually recycle find themselves the target of shady exporters. Plant manager Craig Lorch has been in the business for more than 20 years.
We get regular requests from brokers that are in other countries looking to buy materials, buying computers, metals, laptops, anything with valuable materials in them. We don't sell to them. We don't know what they're going to do with the materials. We don't know where it's going to go.
Craig is part of a minority of conscientious recyclers who collaborate with Jim Puckett and the Basel Action Network. But many U.S. recyclers do export. The Basel Action Network estimates that between 20 and 50 e-waste containers leave U.S. harbors every day. To find out where exactly U.S. e-waste is exported to, Jim came up with a very effective spying technique.
We will just go around to these people calling themselves recyclers, and you drive by them, and the beauty is that you can't hide a big old 40-foot container. So it's very easy to photograph them, and they have prominent numbers, and we take pictures of those, and we date them.
Jim then goes online to find out where the e-waste containers are headed.
I can type that number into a database called Track Trace, and here we see the whole record of that particular container in its last week's voyages. It's gone from Thailand to Singapore, now it's in New Zealand.
Analyzing the main trading routes for U.S. e-waste, Jim made a surprising discovery.
It comes through Hong Kong almost 65% of the time from the U.S. We didn't know that till we started tracking and tracking and tracking. Wow, they're all going to Hong Kong.
Hong Kong Harbor is the third largest port in the world, and any e-waste sent by the U.S. to Asia enters through here. But why isn't it seized and returned straight to sender? ...63,000 containers arrive here every single day on merchant ships of all shapes and sizes. Vincent Wong oversees the customs team at the harbour. The biggest terminal, Kwai Sing, receives nearly 50,000 containers a day. Up to 100 of them are estimated to contain e-waste. Tracking them down is a challenge.
Hong Kong is a free port. That means that the ship and the cargo don't have to declare to customs at the point of entry right away, except they are demanded by customs officers. They only need to declare after 14 days, within 14 days of the import or export of a consignment.
This means that by the time Wong and his colleagues receive the customs declaration, the cargo has usually long moved on. To combat this loophole, the customs inspectors pull out any containers which ring an alarm bell. For instance, because of the company's history or a tip-off from abroad, and submit them to an X-ray scan.
We can scan a container truck in less than 2 minutes, the whole truck. And then, if necessary, we'll open the container for further inspection.
E-waste has its very own shape and look under an X-ray scanner. Items like computer monitors stand out clearly.
For e-waste, we have quite a number of cases in the past few years, and most of them are declared as plastic scrap or metal scrap.
Up to 36,000 e-waste containers are estimated to enter through Hong Kong Harbour every year, enough to fill 20 of the largest cargo ships. About 40 containers a year are intercepted, sent back, and their owners prosecuted.
We do not process each and every container coming or going out of Hong Kong. Around the world, there's no one custom administration that can process 100% of them.
As a result, there are always containers that escape the authorities. Chinese activists are trying to find out what happens to them.
I always want to do something to make some change. So I joined Greenpeace since 2002. The first campaign is working on the e-waste.
Lai Yun is investigating how the e-waste containers slipping through the controls at Hong Kong get to mainland China. Just north of Hong Kong Island in the New Territories, there is a perfect hiding place for e-waste in transit. Lai Yun has come to pick up the trail.
I heard about a lot of e-waste from the overseas, like the United States, coming to Hong Kong.
He soon finds a storage yard. The e-waste shipments await transport over the border. And since the storage of e-waste is not illegal, the authorities are turning a blind eye. There are dozens of yards in this area. The site contains everything from TV sets to monitors and computers. If these, as usually claimed on customs declarations, were really exported as usable second-hand goods, they wouldn't be sitting out in the open air in the rain.
I think that China and the United States so important work together to solve the e-waste problem. This is an international issue.
From the storage yards, the e-waste is smuggled across the border into mainland China. It's just a few miles away, but it's illegal.
The trucks reload in New Territories and drive across very close, and they have to pay a bribe. It's the only way they could get across. Or you use a small coaster boat and go up the Pearl River Delta into areas like Nanhai. And there, again, you'd pay a bribe to unload it.
Once the e-waste is crossed the border, it travels to places like the town of Guayu.
When we went to the Guayu, we don't see any signs to say, okay, this is Guayu. But we just smell, very strong, the smell. Okay, we know we arrived at Guayu.
Guiyu is one of many Chinese towns and villages where illegal e-waste recycling is happening on an industrial scale. No. 80% of the population are involved, processing millions of tons of e-waste a year with the connivance of the industrialized nations. The owners of the yards buy the waste abroad for peanuts, then recycle it using cheap labor. No money is spent treating the toxic leftovers or protecting the workers, so an item can be recycled for a tenth of the cost charged in Europe or the US. As opposed to the African dump sites, in Guayu, there is a division of labor.
Very typical local family workshop. The workers also recycle the plastic or CRT. This guy used the light to burn the plastic and classify different steps.
Separating different kinds of plastic by burning and smelling them is a cheap and effective technique, but it damages the lungs. Another family workshop specializes in recovering minute amounts of gold by dipping motherboards into acid baths. The workers are risking cancer by breathing in the toxic smoke. Afterwards, the remaining acid is simply dumped in the river. The groundwater has also been polluted, and even a simple cup of tea is laced with toxins. The constant exposure to substances such as PCBs, lead and mercury is causing numerous health problems, including nerve and brain damage, skin diseases, and a rise in birth defects.
Really what's happening is people are externalizing costs. You don't want to solve the problem, you'd rather let someone else deal with it, and you'll never have to pay for it. You don't ever get a bill from China saying, you contaminated my land, you have to pay.
China's factories in the neighboring provinces, for instance in Shanghai, Yangzhou, and Guangdong, immediately buy up any recycled materials, such as copper, aluminium, iron, gold, and plastics. But e-waste recycling is not only about selling scrap materials. An even more lucrative business is the recycling of computer chips. In clandestine workshops, transistors, integrated circuits, and other components are taken off discarded motherboards. The harvested parts are sorted and cleaned and sold as brand new components for the production of new electronics. This trade is said to be worth 100 billion euros a year. But it carries a huge risk that has an impact all over the globe, wherever computer chips are a part of our lives. For instance, in trains, planes, cars, nuclear power plants, hospitals, in short, everywhere. The companies who build the control systems for this kind of equipment are finding it increasingly difficult to distinguish between new chips and refurbished ones, and to be sure that their products on which many lives depend are safe. For TQ Systems in Germany, this is a daily challenge. Since the original label has been painted over, it's hard to know which type of chip it really is. Clues pointing to the origin of a chip on the scrap heap are broken and missing pins, or labeling that has been scratched off with a crude and blunt instrument. If the chips were sold as new, they should have come from a factory like this facility in Dresden, where new chips are produced in a highly controlled environment. But the scratched surfaces point to a different origin. Guayu, or another e-waste recycling village somewhere in the developing world. And this means that the chips might be damaged. Major chip manufacturers have started to employ investigators to keep tabs on the situation.
We're currently investigating a case where a customer had purchased from the open market a power module. They introduced them into a public transportation system, and after 1 month of usage, they exploded.
The module had burnt out inside. Stephen Jetta and his team found out that it had been fraudulently relabeled with a higher temperature resistance, probably because a high resistance fetches a better price.
You can imagine if you have a power module that's originally developed in an environment where maximum voltage is 1200 voltage, and it's been remarked in 2400 voltage, it's not going to last.
TQ Systems have decided to check every single batch of chips on arrival using a special X-ray system. it will take time and effort to find out if the skewed connection is harmless or likely to cause a malfunction. Mike is back in Ghana and observing a steady stream of containers arriving from all over the world. Why do the Ghanaian authorities not seize the e-waste on arrival and only let in the functional second-hand goods? A young Ghanaian investigator, Anas Aramayo, has some answers. Anas always works undercover and has never shown his face in public. He recently took his hidden camera to Tema Harbour, Ghana's main port.
E-waste was one of the biggest areas that we looked into. For example, most fraud happened through the e-waste system. Customs have a form of valuation for such home appliances or goods, and the valuation is next to nothing. Somebody goes to clear used goods from the West, and they would look at it as condemned goods, so you're not going to pay the value that you would pay ordinarily.
At Tema Harbour, no one is really interested in separating working goods from waste. Everything is declared as waste and let in virtually tax-free, with the help of a bribe, or a little present for the customs officers.
Many of my footage, you see the SEPS officers walking through the e-waste. First of all, they themselves start picking some that they think is useful.
Then the importers sell the material. The working items go to the second-hand market, the rest to the scrap dealers. For the buyers, it's a gamble, as up to 90% can be broken or in need of repairs.
There was nothing like anybody's going to check the efficacy. In fact, at the sales point, you are told that this is it. It may have a fault or not. For example, if you take about 30 of them, the ones that will be working well will be about 2 or 3. But then the people who buy also rely on doing some repair work on it.
The items that work or can be repaired go on sale in the streets of Accra.
Majority of Ghanaians, about 90% of Ghanaians, would want to depend on these second-hand equipment. So there are new phones, there are new laptops, but it is still expensive and people don't have the money to afford these things.
The second-hand market is thriving. A functional 10-year-old computer siphoned off the recycling system in Europe or the US trades for 25 euros upwards. But there is a big problem with imported second-hand equipment. Often it has only a very short lifespan left.
We should control not only the waste, but the near end of life equipment, so things that become waste really quickly.
Ghana doesn't have any recycling facilities, so any equipment coming into the country, be it e-waste to be scrapped, new electronics, or second-hand imports, sooner or later ends up on a dump site. Ironically, many of the old appliances will have been officially charged to the recycling system in Europe before being exported. But the ones doing the actual recycling work are a group of kids who eke out a living selling the small amounts of metal they can recover. This can hardly be called efficient recycling. All this raises a seemingly naive question. Given that when we buy a new computer in Europe, its recycling is included in the purchase price, shouldn't this money end up with the person doing the actual recycling, wherever they may be on the planet? If European e-waste continues to go abroad, shouldn't the European recycling system be extended and used to set up modern recycling plants in places like Ghana? Or what about a totally different approach? While harbour controls failed to prevent the e-waste from entering, while broken electronics are traded freely on the internet, while e-waste travels the seas by the container load, while Europe and the US won't stop the ships from leaving, while recycling facilities in Europe are leaking like sieves to shady brokers. We need to remember who is at the start of the e-waste chain. The consumer. Few of us can resist the latest gadgets, and we have got into the habit of constantly replacing them with the latest model after a very short time. Last year, worldwide, nearly 50 million flat panel TV sets were sold, 300 million PCs, and 2 billion mobiles and smartphones. Sales figures for consumer electronics are constantly on the rise, and not only in Europe, but also in emerging markets such as India, China, and Africa. Maybe it's time to redefine our roles as consumers and start using our gadgets for a longer time, before the entire planet is littered with discarded appliances that have a long and toxic life ahead of them as e-waste.
Perhaps it's important for the consumers to be aware of how overconsumption and subsequent illegal dumping causes suffering to other human beings across the globe. Perhaps this will lead to more responsible choices, but the bottom line is that governments in the EU and the US must take full responsibility by putting better regulations and systems in place. This toxic tide plaguing the world cannot be stopped while so many governments in the developed world are willing to turn a blind eye. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kHz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11880 kHz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is for a better life from IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Sayyid Mahdi Tawakkol. I am at your service to talk about another strategy that helps us enjoy a more appropriate life based on the concepts of the Quran and Islamic narrations. Today, I will be going to talk about the consequence of being dependent to Allah only. As a preface to my speech, I need to say, man is a creature that depends on living with other people. No one can live alone, and no one can acquire everything he needs. The smallest social group is the family. Then in the greater extent, there are relatives, and in the next and broader stage, friends and members of a community when a person lives can be named. It is natural that the closer people are to each other, the more love and affection exist between them. For this reason, the love that exists in a family between parents and children, or between husband and wife, or even between siblings or close relatives, this love and affection is more than the love that exists between friends and distant relatives. As a result, if someone has a problem or needs help, his family and his close relatives are more expected to help him and to take his hands. Again, back to the title of my discussion. As those who hear my voice through this program may know, I usually intend to accentuate the role of God in life. Let me focus on this point and say, the way that family members and close relatives help each other is one of the blessings that God has given to human. Because with the love that God has created between the family members, they instinctively help each other and they meet each other's needs. For this reason, the father provides the food and what his children need without any discomfort. Or the mother, we see that takes care of her children and does it impulsively without expecting to be appreciated, be thanked, or thinking about to be rewarded or not. Even she would be excited to see her children have become happy. All of these sources of favor are emanated from the favor of Allah. Then, if a man is dependent to his family and relatives, he should firstly pay attention that he is dependent to the favor of Allah. Because of this, sometimes in a family, especially among those who have a materialistic view, a member of a family or a relative is rejected. We know that being rejected and being refused by those whom we love and expect assistance is definitely painful. But in this situation, the same God who in normal situation calls the family members to help each other, on this condition, when they do not give help to one of their members, God assists him in other ways and does not leave his servant alone. Imam Ali, in one of his noble sayings, considers this point and says, "Man ضيعه الأقرب أتيح له الأبعد." He who is abandoned by near ones, like his family and relatives, will become dear to remote ones, and they will support him instead. The tradition can also connote this point, that sometimes when people need help, they refer to the available means and refer to the tools and the methods that are reachable. But if these ways does not work, Allah implements for him other ways, the ways that the man would have never thought about them already. The fact is that if God decides to help someone, even if his relatives and his close friends do nothing for him, God uses other people and implements different paths that can be even more effective for him. God guides the member of a family and relatives to instinctively
help each other. But if for any reason they decide not to help one of their members, God instead will help him in other ways. The mentioned hadith of Amir al-Mu'mineen has two messages for us. One is that those who are relatives and friends are more responsible to help each other and to meet each other's need. Secondly, if someone is not supported by his relatives and friends, he should not be disappointed, should never think that no one is there to help him. We see in many cases that a father may abandon his son, a mother may show unkindness to her child, a cousin may ignore the need of his cousin, and so on and so forth. But Allah, who is the most merciful to his creature, does not abandon his worthy servant. As a result, if a person does not receive help from those he expects help, he should not be disappointed. He has to know that God, who is always present and is always able, will help him.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
It is God's wisdom and it is His mercy that people are supported by close relatives and friends. But if the relatives do not fulfill their duty and neglect responsibilities of mercy and friendship, Allah will put this responsibility on others, so that Allah's servant will not be left alone in the midst of unfortunate events. Even sometimes God arranges the person's life program in such a way that man does not receive help from those who expect help. Pay attention to this point, so that his dependence on God increases. And man will realize that the only one who does not reject him is the merciful God. Let me make an example from the history of Islam. It is stated that after the Holy Prophet presented his mission to his relatives and said that he is the Prophet of God, and his relatives, who are the closest to him, are more responsible to believe in him and to help him, the Quraysh clan, who were the Prophet's close relatives, not only did not support him, but also showed their enmity and hatred. And even more than that, they started fighting against the Prophet. But God instead raised the most distant tribes from the Quraysh, namely Us and Khazraj, to support him. Those tribes supported him, supported the Prophet wholeheartedly, and aided to promote his religion. The result was that those distant tribes, who in the beginning were not assumed to help the Prophet, helped him much more than the Prophet's relatives. And because of this, the Prophet was soon able to spread the religion of Islam throughout the Arabian Peninsula with the help of God. Imam Sadiq says in a meaningful narration, "Kun liman la tarju alja min kalima tarju." Be more hopeful about what you have no hope than what you have hope for. It means that sometimes God places the key to the solutions and progresses on a path that man does not expect much, but instead on the way that man imagines to be resultant, God does not put that much benefit. So that by this way, God trains his servant to try to increase his dependence on him more than to be dependent on any other material and worldly means. A person's family, relatives, and his bosom friends are not more kind and powerful than God. A person should always put his hope in God more than even his closest people. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear.
tear on every eyelash.
He knows
every thought I have and every word I share.
He knows,
Allah knows.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.